Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 869 in Isleta Pueblo, I'm Tara Gatewood. Indigenous people to Mexico have a dynamic culture. There are also similarities with Native nations in the United States. Both live with a legacy of colonialism, and their identities revolve around family connections, language, and culture. And Indigenous people from Mexico often struggle against negative perceptions, both in their home country and in the United States. Coming up, we'll talk about Indigenous Mexican identity and heritage. We go live right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Tonto National Forest in Arizona will be rescinding the final environmental review that triggered the land swap of Oak Flat, a sacred site, to a mining company. Emma Gibson from Arizona Public Media reports.
If the land transfer takes place, the proposed copper mine would be one of the largest in the country, one day transforming Oak Flat into a crater. Attorney Luke Goodridge is representing Apache Stronghold, one of the groups opposing the transfer. He calls the rescinded review a temporary retreat.
But a temporary retreat doesn't solve the problem. The government is still planning to transfer and destroy Oak Flat, and Oak Flat and the Apaches still need legal protection.
Soon after, the federal government responded to an emergency injunction filing on the project. It says it doesn't think there's a need for it, especially since the land exchange will probably be delayed by the rescinded final review. It says a change in land title doesn't pose an immediate harm to the site, and mining is years away. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
The country's leading infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, says tribal nations will be able to get single-dose COVID-19 vaccines being approved by the federal government. Over the weekend, the U.S. authorized Johnson & Johnson's single-shot vaccine.
I just have been in consultation with our medical team, and the plan for the distribution of the J&J vaccine will that it will be equitably distributed in exactly the same way that the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines have been distributed. It's based on population per state. And then when you get tribal nations, the same mechanism that got the Moderna and the Pfizer to you will get the J&J to you.
Tribes across the country have been using the two-dose vaccines with distribution through the Indian Health Service or states. IHS officials ahead of J&J approval last week said the IHS will use all available vaccines authorized by the government. Fauci is serving as chief medical advisor to President Biden, leading the administration's COVID-19 response team. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe in South Dakota is relaxing checkpoint restrictions on the reservation to allow vehicles through regardless of residency or business. The checkpoints have been part of the tribe's COVID-19 emergency response. The decision comes after consultation with medical professionals, the Public Health Task Force, and as COVID-19 vaccinations take place in the community. Checkpoints will remain as part of contact tracing. Spokesperson Remy Baldeagle says the restrictions may change due to potential outbreaks.
If, for instance, a hotspot happened on a community off the reservation and there was an outbreak, then because there's different variances of the virus that are coming out, if an outbreak happens on a community off the reservation, we may still, you know, go back to those more strict applications in regards to that particular area.
Last year, tribal checkpoints faced scrutiny by the state's governor, Kristi Noem, who said they interfered with interstate commerce. Tribes kept their checkpoints, failing to reach an agreement with the state. Public health teams in Colorado are collaborating with the Southern Ute Tribe for a mobile COVID-19 testing event on the reservation and surrounding community Tuesday to gather data on the virus. Over the weekend, the tribe confirmed the discovery of the California COVID-19 variant on the reservation. Its origin is currently under investigation. It was found in a sample from an individual with COVID-19 who recently died. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Support by the Sanoski Chambers Law Firm, championing tribal sovereignty and defending Native American rights since 1976, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, joining you from my homeland, Xihxihxtli, via Skype. As in this country, indigenous people in Mexico suffered violent colonial oppression. It's a legacy that continues to define who they are and where they live to this day. But there are a number of differences between the political and cultural realities on the two sides of the U.S.-Mexico political border. We'll dive into that and more with our guests this hour, and we'd like to hear from you too. Do you have indigenous Mexican heritage? And how do you carry that identity here in the United States? Join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Today, we're going to start off in Denver, Colorado. With us on the line is Renee M. Chacon. She is a youth program coordinator at Spirit of the Sun, co-founder of Women from the Mountain, and a chamadora of Danza Azteca. And it is our pleasure to have her here. She is Dene and Mexica. Welcome to Native America Calling, Renee.
Buenos dias, Clarissa Netzi. Good morning.
Renee, great to have you here. And just thinking about this topic, and definitely, you know, we have these phone lines for anybody who'd like to join us. Again, the number is 1-800-996-2848. And for you, what would you say, or how do you factor in, or your thoughts on why indigenous identity from Mexico has been distanced from not only indigenous people who carry the blood, but also the two countries that have connections to these great nations?
We're not able to have representation from our own self-determination. I'm Dene Chicana, I'm Dene Mexica from Denver, Colorado, which is the land of the Ute, Cheyenne, and Arapaho people, but also 48 tribes, including the Mexica. And that's the many different tribes, those are Chichimeca, Toteca, and Azteca, civilizations that have gone through what we call Colorado, that now was colonized through the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And now they don't recognize the mixed cultures and the mixed indigenous cultures, even those that were enslaved, like the Jenizaros in the Southwest. And we're never able to express that from our own self-determination, that we're mixed indigenous. We come from mixed indigenous. We're both colonized and colonizer, but we align with our indigenous side. And we want to claim that in our Chicano and self-determination.
And how is that received, do you feel, both by people who carry the blood as well as outsiders?
We get typecast as Hispanic or Latino, but that's still validating more of a white supremacy in its language and literal meaning. But to align with our own indigenous side is to align with, if you can find your indigeneity. So for me, I was lucky to grow up in my culture in Denver, and I grew up as a little mestizo. Now they call it ballet folklorico dancer. Now I'm a danzante. And we did practice in our ceremonies in our own way, and I hold the smoke under my mother-in-law, Lucila Contreras, too, and the women here. And I learned our culture directly in my indigenous, that I knew I was a mixed tribe. We knew where we came from, the San Luis Valley of Colorado, as even Navajo and Apache people that mixed with Mexica people, and also the colonizers here, too. So I was very lucky. My father-in-law literally is an anthropologist as well. And my father and mother also well entwined with their family history and oral tradition. And that held as a resilience for my culture, but that's not true for everyone. And we need to return to representations of that from our own authenticity and being able to tell our own stories through that oral tradition now in the modern identity, because it's just not the American identity you see. It's the one that's the invisible identity underneath through all the treaties that were never honored.
And Renee, when you think of all these different layers that have pushed back celebrating Indigenous identity, what is your thought? Is there anger, frustration, understanding, or where do you stand? Because that's a lot to have just glossed over.
I'm hopeful because we're able to define ourselves past the government definition. And that now goes past what the American identity and what colonizers have pushed on us through a lot of forms of predatory capitalist forms. Now we're able to rehone our own narratives and speak our own truth. And yes, it is redistribution of narratives and eventually redistribution of wealth. We don't want anybody hijacking our narratives. We want to be able to speak for ourselves. But at the same time, we also want to reclaim our sacred spaces and reclaim our sacred land. And even here in Colorado, we work with the Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Ute tribes. And I myself a Chicano, so I can only be Chicano here or Chicana here. And it's being able to align all these different but diverse narratives that were not monolithic and was past the government and even the romanticism of Indigenous identity and the American identity, that we want to be able to reclaim our own spaces, name our own land, name our own mountains like the Ute and Cheyenne here. Instead of Mount Evans, it's Blue Sky Mountain. And instead of S Mountain, which is Squaw Mountain, which is a horrible term for women, we're hoping can turn to Owl Woman Mountain, but most of all in their native tongues to be called that, because it's past just being able to define it in English and define it by a white identity, but to finally redefine it in the modern Indigenous identity. That's hopeful to me because that's past what the government has defined us as. And that's for what our future generations need and what our past generations have fought so long to hold the resilience of that invisible identity for.
Well, I thank you for breaking it down with us. If you'd like to chat with Renee, dial in now. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We are talking about Indigenous identity. And what about Indigenous peoples whose homelands are in Mexico and also in the United States? If you'd like to join our conversation, call us right now. 1-800-996-2848. Also here, too, from Ohlone Land in California is Roberto Fetal. They are a filmmaker and Ute, Rarámuri, and Spanish. Our pleasure to have them here. Roberto, thank you for joining us. Welcome to Native America Calling.
Hey, what's up? It's good to be back on.
Yes, great to have you here. And Roberto, same thing too, wondering what your thoughts are, what you found, or just, you know, wondering about what are the things that have covered up Indigenous identity from Mexico?
Literally everything Renee said is dead on. It's like, I mean, it's, she's speaking for so many people with those words, because those are exactly my feelings. I mean, you mentioned, Renee, you're dope. You mentioned everything. You're talking about the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. You're talking about this self-determination. Like looking at that specific moment in time when you talk about the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, I think that's something that's really got to get broken down because I don't know. I'm trying to think of where to start. Renee kind of really hit everything that I like wanted to say. So I'm really grateful that she had those words. So I don't really actually know if I have too much more that I could offer that conversation. She like really hit everything. Like she's great. That was really amazing. I don't know. I don't really have anything else to offer that specific conversation.
And so Roberto, what about your own personal story within your family? Was your Indigenous heritage celebrated fully, or do you have a different story?
I guess that is something I could offer, just a specific kind of version of the information Renee was giving us. So my two Indigenous ancestral lines come from a really violent colonization. And so I'm from my Ute side of my family's from New Mexico and Southern Colorado, and there was this this is kind of funny, Renee. My last Fetal is my performance name. One of my family last names is Chacon, and we're from Southern Colorado and Northern New Mexico, And with that ancestor, I always thought Chacon was like a mestizo last name. I thought somehow I'm a Chacon and I have some Spanish ancestor who's a Chacon, and they somehow, like, probably non-consensually and violently, you know, gave birth to my grandfather or my great-grandfather, you know, as a part of colonization or slavery or something. And, you know, over a decade ago, my brother and I were doing a lot of work into our family line, because when you're Chicano, you kind of get, you know, leeway to just be like, all right, you're brown, you're Chicano. Like, that can be your identity if you want it to stop there, you know? And I think what a lot of folks now are doing is being like, it just doesn't stop there. Like, when I go to the sunrise ceremony at Alcatraz, the brown berets are there as well as, like, you know, indigenous folks, and I think there's starting to be more of a understanding that we all have a shared history. It just kind of panned out a little bit differently for certain reasons, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo being one of those reasons specifically. But, you know, like, we could have stopped at that Chicano identity and been like, again, I work in post-apocalyptic sci-fi cinema, being like, Chicano is our post-apocalyptic identity. It's our detribalized, colonized identity. It's like an identity that came out of us fighting through colonization. Yes, we kind of lost attachment to our tribal histories. We know we're not white people. We know we're not Anglos, but we have formed a culture and an identity of survival and vibrancy that is mixed with Spanish. It is mixed with indigenous, specifically Mexica. I'm not Mexica, but that's kind of like the big mix you see a lot in Chicano culture, Chicana culture. But with that being said, in my own family's history, we found out that Chacon was actually a slave name. So my great-grandfather, Jose Antonio Chacon, my grandfather's dad, was a Ute man who, as a boy, was quote-unquote baptized, which just means put into slavery, in the home of this Spanish man named Tomas Chacon in New Mexico, who was like 80 or something like that.
Roberto, hang tight. I want you to finish this story because I'm sure people are relating to this as well. We got to take a break. We'll pick up right after that. But you're also welcome to join us. Dial now. Don't wait longer. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And just want to know how you connect to all of this. Give us a ring. Again, phone lines are open. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Hang tight. We got more ahead today here on Native America Calling. It's been a difficult year for frontline healthcare workers. The pandemic has added to what is already a challenging profession. The people charged with helping others to heal don't always get the recognition they deserve. So, we're celebrating the hard work Native healthcare workers perform on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo. We are talking about Indigenous Mexican identity and heritage today. What does your connection to the Indigenous people in Mexico mean to you? And how does it translate across the political border between the United States and Mexico? Give us a call. Join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. It's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Here with us today out of Denver, Colorado, is Renee M. Chacon, and she is a Shamarora of Danza Azteca. She is Dene and Mexica. Also here, too, is Roberto Fetal, and they are a filmmaker and also Ute, Rarámuri, and Spanish. Her pleasure to have them here, too. And Roberto, please take us back to the story, understanding more about the name Chacon and your family connections.
Yeah, just to make a very long story short, you know, I thought that this was part of my mestizo mix Spanish and indigenous identity, and I found out that this name was just directly a slave name. My great-grandfather, Jose Antonio Chicón, who was a Ute person, was taken at a young age, given as a slave to this man named Tomás Chicón, and I didn't know that. I mean, it makes sense now. I'm such a goofball. I didn't get why I didn't know this earlier. But yeah, you give your slaves your last name in Mexico in that time. You know, and Mexico was Mexico at that time. And so my great-grandfather got that name. And when this person died and my great-grandfather, you know, was free, you know, there was this Ute man walking around New Mexico with this Spanish last name and had no attachment to his tribe, didn't know where he came from. And that kind of like spiritual crisis got passed down in my family for years. And, you know, my brother and I are still recovering from what that act of violence did to my family line. And I saw it with my grandfather, who was, you know, a very spiritually harmed indigenous man without, you know, with practices of his culture and practices of our culture. And, but also this crisis of like, who am I? Because, you know, they left New Mexico in the 50s or 60s and came out here to California. And in California, because, you know, there are like not really other Ute folks out here in the way there are in Southern Colorado and New Mexico, my grandfather kind of just started identifying as like Chicano, as Mexican American. And because technically he was like, or kind of was, you know, New Mexico was pretty recently had just gone from being Mexico to the United States. And as a result, I think there was just this massive identity crisis. You know, it's like that's Ute ancestral land in New Mexico and Colorado. And then all of a sudden it's Spain, because these colonizers violently come and take over, and then it's Mexico, and then it's the United States. I can't even imagine what that kind of multiple apocalypse was like for him and for my parents, and or for my mom and her sisters. And, you know, I think that's why I focus so much on post-apocalyptic cinema that centers mestizos, that centers indigenous folks, because I want to create like a modern mythology around what this is like, and also show our communities like the medicine and the skills we have to survive this stuff, because we have survived it before, and we've created these really beautiful, vibrant, mixed cultures out of all of this. So, yeah.
And Roberto, being able to express some of this in your art, do you feel that you're creating a much needed, well, I'm not even asked that because I know the answer is yes, but creating this kind of dialogue through your art, who are you really hoping to reach?
I mean, I hope it's my community. I hope it's people like Renee, who, I mean, Renee, come be in one of my movies. You sound amazing, by the way. but yeah, like, I think it's our communities. You know, I want to make, you know, again, I said on the last show, I was raised in South Sacramento, California, and going to Southside Park, you know, on weekends and seeing, you know, the murals by the Royal Chicano Air Force, who were people who were, to a degree, channeling indigeneity, like post-apocalyptic indigeneity as Chicanos, as brown folks, and but detribalized folks, you know, like when Renee mentioned the Inesarios earlier in New Mexico. But those murals told our stories. You know, and they were accessible to everybody in our community, and everybody could understand them, whether or not you had a fine art degree or you were a professor or whatever, like you got those, and they were in our spaces. And I hope that my films can be like moving image muralism for our community and keep our stories, you know?
Indeed. And there's a lot of people who are ready for this dialogue. I know you are too. Go ahead and dial in 1-800-996-2848. And also here too with us today from Tongva, Los Angeles, is Claudia Cerato, and she is an indigenous culinary artist and anthropologist and a decolonial scholar and co-founder of Across Our Kitchen Tables, a women and cis women of color culinary hub. And she is indigenous Mexican of Purépecha, Huasteca, and Zacateca descent, and her politic of identity Her politic of identity is Chicana Indígena. It's our pleasure to have her here with us today. Claudia, welcome to Native America Calling.
Thank you. Pleasure to be back.
Great to have you here. And Claudia, tell us anything you want to jump on when it comes to understanding your Indigenous identity, things that forces that have pushed celebrating it out in the open, or even just understanding lineage. Go ahead. Tell me more.
You know, there's a lot really to unpack here and to share. Immediately, I think about my Indigenous identity and how I arrived to embrace, right, who I am as an Indigenous woman. And, you know, honestly, there's a lot of politics, right, particularly around land and Indigenous erasure. And the first thing that comes to mind for me is my childhood upbringing. I always knew that I was Mexican or was growing up in Mexican culture, but it was never defined and it was never called out. It just was, right? And so a lot of my upbringing were based off of what my parents and their parents, right, the ethics and the values and the morals and the way we process our food, the way we laugh, the way we love, the way we parent. And for me, those teachings became, you know, part of my living reality. And later on, as I began to really reflect critically on issues around identity, I realized, wait a minute, these are all, I have always been raised around Indigenous principles and values. Those are what have allowed me to survive and continue to persevere in all of what I do today, particularly in working with food. I think a lot about tactics that have been applied, right, within, you know, Mexico and in the U.S. to really dispose of Indigenous bodies, Indigenous culture, Indigenous epistemologies, ways of how we know and what we know. And what I always look at for teachings and reflections is the Indigenous cultural heritage foods I was raised with, because I have found that in having a relationship with food, right, there's exchanges that occur, ancestral memory exchanges through, right, communality, coming with family together, but then also to the food itself. And so, you know, I again, yes, there's a lot of problematics, but I'm here to celebrate what continues to thrive and survive, and too, right, in a very strategic manner, because I feel that Indigenous teachings are really encoded in memory, which is what our food and our lands embody.
And Claudia, when you think of this too, and from a colonial construct, you know, there's a lot that's laid upon Indigenous people. And understand that you also think of the concept of purity and just how much it has disrupted identity. Anything you want to share to just kind of give our listeners a little bit more understanding too of how things were truly imposed in the country of Mexico too on Indigenous people?
Yeah, sure. You know, so, I mean, like Roberto and Renee have shared, right, there is a deeply profound colonial history that, you know, part of it is public and part of it is private. And the components that many of us are aware of, you know, really in the making of Mexico, really push back and you know, try to ultimately eliminate through various forms of extermination in the Indigenous peoples. And this was due to a colonial mindset of superiority, a colonial mindset that placed the white colonial body on top of all other existences. And these particular ideologies is how people were organized, or how people were classified, is how people were ultimately, you know, placed in some type of pan-ethnic labeling. Now, these particular social constructions have evolved, and we see that here in Indigenous, you know, in here in the northern parts, right, in what we call America or the U.S. And these particular ideologies, which are rooted in white supremacy ideologies, or what some folks like to call white settler psychosis, really teach, right, through the social system that we have in place, that there is a type of hierarchy of people. And unfortunately, what we have seen is that these messages have become internalized. And in doing so, then, the average person then begins to perpetuate these ideologies of supremacy, where then people are ranked, right? Folks are ranked depending on where they reside in sort of this color line. And unfortunately, it creates disadvantages for particularly indigenous peoples, because they are considered to be at the bottom of the hierarchy. And these are the ideologies that we see throughout the Americas. And then too, with this introduction of these ethnic labels to really group, which is, again, another form of indigenous erasure, with the creation of, we have from Hispanic, right, to Latino, to Latinx. And yes, it does create this huge gendered spectrum, which is marvelous. But at the same time, what we're doing is we're still, it really speaks to a type of anti-Blackness and anti-Indigenous reality. And so, these identity labels really are complex, because they really affect people in real life, like daily engagements, right? Some folks have advantages that others don't, just for simply being indigenous.
And Claudia, when you think of this, was there ever a time, or even within families, where people just chose to drop the indigenous part to get by, to get a job, to be accepted? Do you have any knowledge of that?
Yes. And it's so, this is going to be hopefully my family in tuning in, or I know my mom might be, but yes, even with the names, right, it's so interesting to see how many family members of mine, and I won't say what their names are, but they changed their names. They, because of fear of not being accepted into white colonial society, because of the names that they carried. And so to be able to integrate, folks had to change their names so that it's easier to pronounce, it's easier to say, so that way, again, we don't disrupture the lives of dominant society and dominant people, quote unquote. And so I've seen it just through the names, right? And going from these very deeply encoded Mexican names to names that we see on TV. It's kind of like what you see, like this Hollywood effect type, where it really creates this form of internalized oppression where there's shame. And so I've seen it in that way. And in other ways too, in food, right? I know even for me as a child, I was really embarrassed to take some of my beans to, my mom would always prepare beans, and I was so embarrassed to take that as, my lunch, because I would be called a beaner. And I used to think that was a bad thing. Now, of course, I've owned up to it. I'm like, oh, I'm very proud. I wear my nopal on my forehead. But again, right, these are stages that we have to overcome, because it's so ingrained and embedded in society, whether it's, in the U.S. side of the border or the Mexican side of the border, it's there and it's alive. And these are ideologies that everyday people really fall into and believe and perpetuate towards really creating indigenous erasure.
And Claudia, for somebody who is beginning their journey to reclaim, any message for that person who does have indigenous identity from Mexico?
Honestly, the one thing that I have found to be the most effective way of being able to gently arrive to understanding one's identity has been through food. So my best suggestion for folks is to return to la comida de la casa, which is return to your home-based foods and meals, the foods that your grandmothers prepared. One, no longer see shame in them, but embrace them, eat them, because food carries identity, right? Food carries our ancestral memories and knowledge, and it's encoded in the DNA. And once we begin to integrate and eat these particular foods, right, it'll activate those memories within our bodies. And then through the way we decolonize our taste buds and through, you know, indigenous foods and the indigenous stories, indigenous memories that these foods and land carry, that knowledge will rise. That knowledge will come out, where then one can easily begin to, right, return to, remember, revitalize, regenerate the indigenous within. And then it's an invitation to explore other realms of coming to one's identity.
And is there a website you'd like to share, People of Colodia, one, if people want to connect with you?
So right now I have my Instagram handle. I'm working on my webpage. It should be out by this summer. So I am at Chicana_indigena, I-N-D-I-G-E-N-A.
All right. Thank you for that. If you'd like to talk directly with Colodia, call in now, 1-800-996-2848. And also here, too, is Renee M. Chacon. And Renee, the Danza Circle is definitely another place where identity is getting stronger. And I definitely want you to share a little bit about that coming up after the break. But again, if you'd like to join us, dial in now, 1-800-996-2848. What are your connections to Indigenous Mexico? 1-800-996-2848 is a number. We definitely look forward to your calls. And if you are relating to what you're hearing on the conversation, come from a tribal nation here in the States, want to make some parallels, go ahead and dial in. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We look forward to adding your voice to our conversation today.
Smoking gave me COPD, which makes it harder and harder for me to breathe. I have a tip for you. If your doctor gives you 5 years to live, spend it talking with your grandchildren. Explain to them that your grandpa's not going to be around anymore to share his wisdom and his love. I haven't figured out how to do that yet. I'm running out of time.
COPD makes it harder and harder to breathe and can cause death. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Thanks for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. Today we are focusing on Indigenous Mexican identity and heritage. And we want to hear from you too. These phone lines are ready for you. Has your understanding of your Indigenous Mexican heritage changed over time? Tell us right now, how did it change your family? 1-800-996-2848. We look forward to hearing from you today. Go ahead and dial in now. Again, 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Here with us on the line today is Claudia Cerrato, and she is an Indigenous culinary artist. Also here, too, is artist Roberto Fatal, and they are coming to us today from Ohlone land in California, and they are Ute, Rarámuri, and Spanish. Also here, too, is Renee M. Chacon, who is a youth program coordinator at Spirit of the Sun, and she is also a Samadora of Danza Azteca. She is Dene and Mexica. Thank you all for being here with us. And Renee, again, I turn to you because we know people are getting stronger by entering the Danza Circle. And talk to me a little bit about that and, you know, bringing culture stronger than it ever was before, and maybe even introducing people to a culture that is in their lineage, but they're just jumping into it for the first time or reconnecting, better word. Go ahead, Renee.
Thank you. I'm so grateful for Roberto and Claudia, too, by the way, and for all you do, for all the medicines that you bring. For Danza, for me, it reminded us that we're not imposters on our own homeland, and that if a place like Colorado means muddy red, that it's not an English name. So it makes you already question your identity. But spaces like Denver, I grew up in urban Denver. My mama's from the east side. My family still resides on the east side, too. And that's actually where our circle is, too, for Cororeslan with Deborah Montoya. And we'll be dancing at Park Hill pretty soon. That it reminds us that in urban spaces where it's predominantly white, where it predominantly has English names, we are not imposters on our own homeland. In a place like Colorado, there were many tribes that traveled through, like Mexica and many other tribes. And Danza is a way to hone it from our own again. self-determination, our own cultural narrative, and our own cultural resilience for the youth coming up. Because spaces like Denver often choke and flush us out through pollution or socioeconomic spaces, and the pendulum swings back and forth. They either want us here to work or they don't want us here, and they push us back out to the rural spaces. And they're often sacrifice zones for pollution. So we use our own self-determination, again, as resilience in these spaces to come back into intention, to remind ourselves, sometimes all you can offer is a dance. Learn that in your indigeneity, and that is sacrificing for that time, really understanding how it's a way of life, that it's a ceremony all the time, that there's a cosmology to it, there's a balance to it, and respect that. And put the time in understanding that it's okay to not be ashamed to reclaim your indigeneity, but to take it slow, and that you're mixed with both colonized and colonizer. That's the biggest thing that I get, is that a lot of youth feel like they're imposters, and you're not. And again, that's hard to say when you have spaces like detention centers. Those are mixed indigenous people too. So we have a lot of systems that are not representing us, and being able to have support as in property, to be able to teach Santa, to be able to have funding for other cultural resilience programs. There's Lakota cultural resilience program. There's many that come through spaces as Denver alone. There's Navajo, Dene, like I am mixed as well, and Apache, and many others that come through that need to be supported in narrative as well to really reclaim our mixed indigeneity and our mixed populations. Because again, we're not monolithic. That's why I appreciate Claudia and I appreciate Roberto so much, is because I'm just my story, but theirs shows so much more history in theirs as well. And that paints so much more of a picture of how much we've been invisible. And now we should be able to claim and have leadership for surviving systems that are not broken. They're working as designed to leave us out. And now we should fix that with real equity analysis. And what does that look like in narratives? And that's reclaiming it directly with, for me, Danza, and teaching first my own children. And my husband's also a fourth generation Danzante. And we actually get Chacon from Priscila Chacon, who's also a Danzante, who's his grandmother. And she knows her history as well as a Janizaro, and what that meant as enslavement as well in Southwest New Mexico, Colorado space. These are stories of trauma, but stories of resilience. So again, being able to bring just the danza with your offering, bring danza with intention and prayer, and really respecting what that means for the elders and those that have preserved those sacred spaces for so long. And now restoring it as you have every other space, as you have every other church, as you have every other community space that gathers. We also deserve those spaces and narratives. We also deserve that taught to our children. We also deserve to speak to our children in our languages. That's self-determination. That's real sovereignty, if you will. So that's what Danza is for me. And,
And maybe we have some other Danzantes listening in today. You want to share some thoughts? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And so, you know, I really appreciate all of you giving us your view and your own personal experience about identity and even your own family stories. And so also want to hear your thoughts on engaging with Indigenous people from the United States. Is there ever any pushback when you talk about your own cultural heritage? Is there anything you'd like to say on that? Claudia, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
Sure. You know, there's been two different types of acknowledgement. One has been an embracement where, you know, there's been recognition of this, you know, man-made border and, you know, conversation and dialogue around being, you know, one family, right? Being from Turtle Island, Abya-Yala, and, you know, understanding, right, the colonial legacies that has created these divisions. And unfortunately, there have been moments where, again, where my indigeneity was challenged because my indigeneity is rooted in indigenous Mexico. And You know, and it was unfortunate because the ideologies that were perpetuated are those that are instilled in Western society, right? So this idea of, that I am not indigenous enough, yet the people that too were critiquing my indigeneity, I mean, they were white passing natives. And, you know, I was really confused by that. I was like, wait, but how am I less native, right? But I internalized that, and I thought, well, I guess I'm not native enough. But it was because there is a different kind of recognition, right? A different kind of representation, like Renee mentioned, right? There, indigenous Mexicans lack that representation here in the U.S. And because of it, for some indigenous communities and peoples that are not aware or engaged, or two, because they have other issues that they're dealing with and trying to work through survivance, because of the disadvantages that they have for being indigenous here in the U.S., right? There's lack of communication, lack of engagement with other indigenous peoples of Mexico. And so it's something that I had definitely had to negotiate and, you know, find a way to defend myself and my people and defend the knowledge that I carry and that I come with. And luckily for me, the outcomes have always been quite positive, where, you know, the conversation turned into an exchange of knowledge, where then, right, we were able to talk about our ignorances and then also to really critique that as to, well, why do they even exist? Why did we not even know this? Or why is it that you know, even being indigenous, there's also a type of, you know, hierarchy that has been created, you know, within a color line. And it's like, well, wait a minute, right? Let us unpack this. And so it's, you know, there's a lot of work. There definitely is a lot of work to do, because I, again, you know, some people have asked me, well, what's your tribe? I'm like, oh, you know, I'm Purépecha Huasteca. We're, you know, I'm indigenous Mexican. And I get this, oh, what? You know, I'm not native enough because I'm not part of a tribally government recognized community. Like, that doesn't mean anything to me, because at the end of the day, there's so many tribal communities and nations that are here residing, have always been here since time immemorial in the U.S. that have no type of recognition, but that doesn't take away from who they are. And so, you know, it's a problem. It is. And, you know, my hope with a lot of this strong indigenous resurgence that we've seen since the 70s to now gives me a lot of hope that a lot of these false ideologies are going to slowly dismantle and move away, so that we can build stronger alliances and stronger modes of indigenous pride and resistance and ultimately sovereignty.
Well, thank you for that, Claudia. And Roberto and Renee, I want to get your take on that to let you add what you'd like to. Before I do that, we got a caller we're going to bring in. We're going to say hi to Ray, who's in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Ray, thanks for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. And thanks to everyone on the panel today for your leadership in this space. We need to retell the history. I recently sat in on a seminar by Dr. Jamal Martin at the University of New Mexico. The gentleman is a genius. And we talked about reparations in terms of correcting the history. Now, me personally, as a Chicano, I have always embraced both my Spanish and Native heritage and roots, and I'm very proud of both. But I believe that we can correct the history books, and in so doing, really offer some reparations in a small way to Native communities and to their contribution to the Southwest and to the United States and to the world.
Well, Ray, thank you for reaching out. And a couple more minutes left. If you dial fast, you can probably get in. 1-800-996-2848. And Roberto, anything to add?
I just want to say matetaraba and gracias to Claudia and Renee, just for your stories and your wisdom and all the medicine that's in those stories. And Claudia, I just want to say that I kind of teared up when you're talking about the bringing beans to school, because, you know, like my abuela would make food for us, you know, really beautiful food, like very traditional, beautiful food, you know, that came from the Three Sisters. And I would bring that to this like Catholic elementary school that I went to in Sacramento, California, at, you know, which all of these Catholic schools up in Sacramento were like leftovers from like missions and I don't, all this. There's so much weirdness with that, but I would get, you know, made fun of a lot. People be like, your food looks like poop. Ew, that's disgusting, blah, 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 blah. And it was just like such a gut-wrenching feeling that this like sacred food was, you know, just being made fun of. In a Catholic school to boot, which is like a part of like the whole mission system and adios, all this other stuff. So I just wanted to thank you for that story because it brought up something from my past too. That's very painful, but also kind of sacred to me and has inspired my own storytelling. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Roberto. And Renee, go ahead. Any thoughts?
I'm so grateful for, again, both of you bringing your medicine and your narrative. Just having that representation is key. I work with youth directly, and especially during COVID, our communities are never going to be the same. We also do food bank and a lot of things at Spirit of the Sun, like 4 or 5 times a week, just food bank alone. But we also offer spaces of resilience, and I guess that's what I want to tell most of all, is that we might be survivors of, for us, when we're taught in the Chicano movement, hijos de la chingada. But that means children of the rape. But we're also resilient. And the generations that held a lot of these oral traditions and these sacred spaces deserve their recognition now and deserve to be highlighted now and deserve to be preserved and protected in every aspect of the identity that's held that resilience for youth. And I'm really grateful for those that are able to bring it in the modern identity, whether you do it digitally, whether you do it through food, whether you do it, whatever medium that you use, the youth is watching. Us teachers are really grateful. And it is the same thing with the frijoles, with the beans as well. I was also made fun of for chile and so many things. And I'm so grateful to hear we weren't alone and we were resilient through it. And here we can tell these stories and we can laugh at them. And that does make us stronger because we still have our heart in the end of that.
And something else too, the word got thrown in there earlier in the conversation, talking about romanticizing. We got a couple of minutes before we wrap things up. And is there anything you'd like to say about, you know, breaking down some of that or even stereotypes? And many times when we talk about indigenous people from Mexico, we see an image that does come from indigenous roots, but oftentimes it is used in a different way of a warrior holding a woman. Anything about romanticizing, breaking it down? Claudia?
You know, you say that image and immediately, like, my body just, you know, got really hard. Because I think, too, you know, something I've learned from Kim Talbert and her work is really looking at ways to, you know, decolonize and dismantle these romantic ideals, right, of the quote unquote the savage, whether it's through the warrior, you know, or through, you know, this hypersexual imagery that occurs, and also to this machismo, right? My initial thoughts go straight again to colonialism and the perpetuating these white models of, you know, what a man and what a woman is supposed to be. And again, it's very problematic because, you know, what we know about our indigenous families in indigenous communities is that they weren't living within these binary constructs, right? You also had, you know, women warriors. You also had men caretakers. You also had folks in between all that, right? Where you had these fluid identities that, you know, really challenge the gender norms that we, you know, are so structured into our society. And so, for me, those notions are just the imagination of. You know, the white imagination of an indigenous past. So I offer people to really look at these imageries very critically and really ask, you know, who and what created these ideologies and their images, right? So that we can begin to also work through dismantling those ideas around romanticizing indigenous, and then too, right?
Sure. And you know, we got to stop there, but I think that's a really good place, a lot to consider. And There's more to be said. Thanks for tuning in today here on Native America Calling. Thank you to all of our guests, our listeners, and our callers, too. We'll be back again tomorrow, right here. I'm Tara Gatewood.
Did you know COVID financial relief in the form of forgivable PPP loans is available to small business owners and independent contractors, including artists? DreamSpring has worked with New Mexicans looking to open or expand their business for over 25 years, and now they're helping provide PPP loans. Information, including how to qualify, at dreamspring.org. That's dreamspring.org. DreamSpring supports this program.
Ah, Gespokanie. Health coverage is important now more than ever. Enroll in Marketplace coverage now through May 15, 2021. Contact your local Indian healthcare provider for more information. Visit healthcare.gov or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.